We're very excited today to have, this is a call that we had to postpone from August because of the hurricane. And it's a, sort of a continuation of the training that Paolo did for us this summer on, you know, Medicaid issues. And Bernie and Marion have agreed to elaborate on that and, you know, just get into a little more depth on some of the Medicaid issues that are affect children in the dependency system. I'm sure most of you are familiar with Bernie Perlmutter's work. His, I could spend the hour talking about him and all that he's accomplished for children in our state. He is a professor at the Miami School of Law, where he is the runs the legal the Children and the Youth Law Clinic, and he's, you know, has a tremendous base of knowledge about children's issues, and has authored many publications and spoken on a you know, a variety of issues regarding children. Miriam Harmatz is the lead counsel for Florida Legal Services, and she similarly has a, you know, a incredible experience and expertise and a number of issues, and she's a particularly an expert on Medicaid issues and those Medicaid issues and how they affect children. So with that, I'm going to hand it over to them. We have provided a, you know, you should have an attachment to the email that was sent about this training with PowerPoint, and I'm going to let Bernie and Miriam instruct you as to what they'd like for you to look at first or what they want you to follow along with the training. If you, for some reason, don't have that email, you can email Liz Damsky. It's Elizabeth Damsky. She's in Citrix right now, and she'll forward you the email. Just some logistical matters, too. I'd encourage you also to make sure you check the email that we sent out with, it has future dates for the trainings in December and January. We did obviously receive CLE credit. That's also on the email. And this will be posted on the website in about a week or two. So, and because it is mandatory to all, for all attorneys, guardian ad litem attorneys, supervising attorneys that are on the call, please remember to remind your staff that if they did not attend today or listen today, then they do need to listen to it as soon as they can once it's posted on the website. Are there any logistical questions before I hand it over to Bernie and Miriam? Okay, thanks.
Hi, well, this is Miriam. I think I'm going to go ahead and start. And the first set of slides you'll be looking at was in Elizabeth's email, and it's titled EPSDT Training November 8th. So if everybody could pull that up, and I will give you a second to do that. And I do apologize for any confusion on those if you downloaded an earlier email. But this, the set that you're looking at, again, is going to, the title page will be EPSDT, What Does It Mean for You and Your Clients, and How Can You Use It? That's slide number one, and it's dated November 12th. I'm going to announce the number of each slide, so it'll be as if we're doing an actual PowerPoint or webinar, and we'll start on slide two. The, and again, also I apologize if any of this is repetitious, but there are a couple of take-home messages, and I'll announce those as we go along. And one is that all children in care should be eligible for Medicaid, and all kids on Medicaid should get any service that's medically necessary. And I know in reality, as you hear this, you're rolling your eyeballs saying, well, that's not the reality that we're dealing with. And I know Bernie's going to be talking more about some of the real-life barriers, both to eligibility and services. Number two, as many of you know, there's a bit of an alphabet soup when you start talking about health care issues for low-income children between ACA and APD and DCF, and that can be kind of confusing. And today we're only going to talk about one part of the alphabet. And that's EPSDT, which stands for Early Periodic Screening, Diagnosis, and Treatment. It is an entitlement, and that's important because that means that anybody who's eligible for a benefit is entitled to it. Lack of funding is not a reason to deny or delay a medically necessary service. And again, I know you hear that in the trenches. You probably hear that every day. There's no money for this. And under EPSDT, under the statutory framework for that service, that cannot be a reason for denial or reduction. Number three, all children on Medicaid are eligible for EPSDT. And that includes most low-income children, children on SSI, and again, to underscore, all of your clients' children in care. And slide four, I listed a lot of the citations to eligibility, and I'm not going to go through those because we do really want to leave some time at the end for questions. But especially for the lawyers on the call, I know we always like to have the citations. On five, we talked about EPSDT, including both S, which is for screening, and T, for treatment. And as you can imagine, most of the issues arise around the T, because that's more expensive treatment. And it includes treatment for any service, any medical service, that's listed in the federal Medicaid statute. So don't be misled by Florida's name for the EPSDT program in this state, which is the Child Health Checkup Program. And that, by choice of those words, suggests that it's just for screening, checkup sounding a lot like screening. It includes the T, the treatment. So moving to slide six, what are the covered services? And first point is, it includes both the mandatory services listed in the federal statute and optional services. So what even an optional service are those services which states can choose or not choose to include in their Medicaid program. But even if the state has not chosen to cover an optional service, if it's listed in the federal statute, then children under 21 are eligible for it under EPSDT. And I listed some of the main services that children in care typically need, and put in bold a very significant, we call it an umbrella service, and I'm going to take the time to actually read that. That's the bottom of your slide, number six. Other diagnostic, screening, preventive, and rehabilitative services, including medical or remedial services recommended for the maximum reduction of physical or mental disability and restoration of an individual to the best possible functional level. Services are also listed, and these are, again, from the federal statute, but they're also listed in the federal regulations in 42 CFR. I didn't list the site to that, but just know there are multiple places where you can find them. In the state statute, in what are called provider coverage and limitations handbooks, which are on the ACA website. ACA is A-H-C-A. I promise not to get into other parts of the alphabet, but for those of you that may not know, that stands for the Agency for Healthcare Administration, and they're the agency that administers the Medicaid program in Florida. On slide seven, I made a note that it's important to realize that even if a state service or definition, whether it's in the state statute or the Florida Administrative Code or one of those handbooks, conflicts with federal law controls. And there's a case citation there, CF versus DCF from 2005, where the DCA held that the service at issue there was personal care. And under Florida's definition of the service, it was limited to services provided in the recipient's home. And this child, CF, needed personal care outside the home, and we were trying to get him coverage for that. And under federal law, the definition of personal care assistance does not limit it to services in the home, and the court therefore found that Florida's definition was improperly restrictive and that the federal definition controls. And that's one of the linchpins of Medicaid law, that that it's a federal-state program, and states have a lot of flexibility, but that federal law always trumps the federal statute and regulations. And so on slide 8, though, I've taken a step back and want everyone to know that not all what we consider medical services are covered for children under EPSDT. For example, habilitation services, and I know a lot of you have children, clients who are have developmental disabilities and are clients of the Agency for Persons with Disabilities, and this issue can come up where they need what are called habilitation services, and those are not covered under EPSDT. Those are services like training for the purpose of developing the functional abilities. These services are typically available under home and community-based waivers. For example, the waiver for persons with disabilities in Florida. But again, as you all know, it's not everybody who needs that waiver service is able to get it because there is a waiting list for that. Unlike EPSDT services, waiver services are not an entitlement. And so on slide 9, as I said, EPSDT services are an entitlement, waiver services are not, but there is a state law which provides that children in foster care have to be moved to the top of the waiting list for waiver services. So a couple of advocacy tips in bold at the bottom of that slide are that if you have clients on the waiting list who are eligible, who meet the medical criteria for enrollment in the waiver for persons with disabilities, try to get them moved to the top of the waiting list under that state statute. And the second tip is that there are a lot of services, again, all of those services listed in the federal statute, which are covered under EPSDT. And so even though sometimes those services are provided by the waiver, could be provided by EPSDT. And so if a service that the child needs can be covered under EPSDT, try to fit it under that coverage while the child is on the waiting list for the waiver. On slide 10, we talk then a little bit strategically about how you can avoid, if your client needs a medical service, how can you, but it's one of those habilitation type coverages, how can you avoid a denial? For example, children with serious mental illnesses often need a bundle of services that are sometimes referred to as wraparound services in order to remain out of an institution. And wraparound services are not listed as a covered service under federal Medicaid law. But if you parse that apart, another example of that is therapeutic foster care. And Bernie and I have had a case where that's come up. So therapeutic foster care is not listed in the statute, but there are services provided through that umbrella of therapeutic foster care or wraparound that are covered under EPSDT, like targeted case management, counseling, psychology, therapy services. And so those then you can go and get covered under EPSDT. I know there must be questions coming up, and it's a little difficult doing this on the phone because I can't tell if your eyes are glazing over or not. But again, we will, if I'm completely losing somebody, we'll do chime in. And if you have lost me entirely on where we are in the slides, let me know. So we're on slide 11, and we're talking about barriers to children getting the services that are medically necessary under EPSDT. One is that some of the services aren't covered on there, and another is that the state has a definition of medical necessity, and all services have to be medically necessary, whether it's for an adult or a child. The fact that it's covered is obviously not reason enough to get it. It has to be, for any of us in any insurance system, you have to need it. And the doctor has to sometimes get prior authorization for you to get it actually covered by your insurance. And the standard for medically necessary in Florida is listed in the Florida Administrative Code, and that is, and it's incorporated in all of the Medicaid provider handbooks, which are used by all of the flipping over to slides 12 and 13, all of the third-party reviewers that look at whether or not a service will be covered, and all of the, for example, a lot of you probably heard of Maximus or First Health, and they look at behavioral health services, and they have to decide whether or not it's medically necessary before it will be covered. And similarly, on slide 13, all of the Medicaid HMOs look at that same state definition of medical necessity in deciding whether or not they're going to cover a service for your client. And 14, I want to spend a couple of minutes on, because that sets out the difference between the federal statute's definition of medical necessity and the state's more restrictive statute. And that slide is number 14. It's comparing the two. And under the federal statute, the Congress provided that states have to cover services necessary to, the language is, quote, correct or ameliorate a physical or mental illness or condition. The standard includes maintenance services, and that's key, because that includes things like personal care and in-home nursing services that are needed to keep the child with disabilities out of an institution. You compare that to Florida's definition of medical necessity, which is much more restrictive. It states that services have to be, quote, necessary to protect life, to prevent significant illness or significant disability, or to alleviate severe pain. And so you can see, when you're a utilization reviewer looking at a request for additional services for private duty nursing, for example, and you're using that state standard as the determining standard for whether or not you're going to approve the hours that the doctor's recommended, that's a very different standard than the first one. And on slide 15, hark back to the CF case, which also, in addition to holding that the federal definition of a benefit, in that case personal care assistance, controls over the state definition, the court also held that Florida's medically necessary definition for children is unlawfully restrictive. That issue, though it seemed settled in Florida, that was not a class action, so it was only a single individual, and the state did not change their rule in spite of our advocacy efforts. And the standard for medical necessity for children is now on appeal in the 11th Circuit. So that, while we think the federal law is clear and other circuits have been clear, we're going to have to wait and see what the 11th Circuit decides. On slide 16, as I mentioned, the state's medical necessity definition is used by all of the entities that provide utilization review for managed care plans. And many of your clients will be in some form of managed care, either for some or all of their services. And significantly, as you all probably know, all children in the all the kids in the child welfare database system have to receive their mental health services through a prepaid mental health plan. The slide notes that there are a few exclusions and uncovered services. For example, children who are in a Medicaid HMO, their behavioral services are are also managed, but through the HMO and not through a separate prepaid mental health plan, PMHP. Again, I'm slipping into there. It's hard to avoid the alphabet, but that's another acronym you probably have heard or are familiar with. And there are also a few non-covered services. I want to speed up on the last few slides. I know we started 5 minutes late, 5 or 10 minutes late, and I don't know if you all can stay on. But there are a lot of advocacy issues around, these definitions of the standard of medical necessity. Is it being applied correctly? On slide 18, I'm mentioning that other services are also going to be managed shortly, including physical, speech, and occupational therapy. That hasn't started yet, but it will be soon. Slide 19, I was going to read it out, but I don't want to take the time now, but star that one. That's a summary. That's some of your take-home messages. EPSTT services that cannot be capped. They may be subject to prior authorization, but the state can't say that children can only get 10 physical therapy sessions per month. If they need more, they're entitled to them. There can't be waiting lists for EPSTT services. So if the child needs hospitalization, the state can't say, but there's a waiting list. Optional services have to be available, and there cannot be any charge. No co-payments like for adults. Slides 20 and 21, I won't spend any time on, but give you the site there to the state rules that refer to the responsibility for ensuring that children in foster care get their services. And slide 22 is also a key, which talks about what can be done when one of your clients has been denied a service. And one of the best tools we have is a fair hearing. And that's especially important if the service at issue is a current service that's being terminated, reduced, or suspended. And in that case, if an appeal is filed within 10 days, either of actual notice, or a lot of times, as you all know, people don't get notices, or you, the guardian ad litem or attorney ad litem or the child, you don't get the right notice. Whenever you get constructive notice, an appeal within 10 days, you have a right to continue that service pending the outcome of the appeal, the child does. And slides 23 and 25, 24, 25, a bit of 23 is a bit of a roadmap for what you could do with your in a typical fair hearing or denial or reduction situation. And I want to stress, too, I've put in my contact information, my colleagues, so you can always call or contact us. And we'll leave you with some questions on slide 24 with... That may segue us into Bernie's presentation for how to actually make this wonderful EPSDT law work for your clients. So, Bernie, take
okay,
it away.
I'll take over from here. I also prepared a little slide presentation. Its title is EPSDT Health Rights Advocacy in Juve Court. And it's a shorter one than Miriam's, and I won't spend too much time on the individual slides. It's about 22 slides long, but many of the slides contain just pasted excerpts from the pertinent statutes, and particularly the Chapter 39 provisions that relate to juvenile court health care advocacy and health care issues that will come up for those of you who represent children day-to-day in these proceedings. And so turning to slide 2, really, it begins the advocacy work that you will do in juvenile court really begins at the time that the child is placed in emergency shelter. At the shelter hearing, there is clear authority under 39.407 for the department to authorize a medical screening to be performed on the child without prior authorization from the court and without obtaining consent from a parent or legal custodian. In effect, this screening that the department is vested with giving the authorization to is that S in EPSDT that Miriam was referring to in her presentation. And what I would stress to you all is the importance of obtaining copies of the screening reports, the medical reports from all of the providers who have been contacted by DCF, to ensure that you begin to create a folder, a file, or a chart of the child's medical records and medical history, commencing at the time that the child is removed from parental or legal custodial care and placed in shelter care. A theme that will run through my presentation is the importance of gathering information about your client, gathering records that pertain to the medical care that the child is receiving or the medical care that the child may not be receiving. And a large part of your responsibility is to essentially gather that information and then analyze it and then consider whether or not it has any relevance to the enforcement of the child's rights under federal law that is, as described by Miriam, that is undertaken in this administrative framework for fair hearings and for ultimately for District Court of Appeal review, if necessary, of the findings and the orders entered by fair hearing officers to determine whether or not it was proper to deny a child or to reduce a child's medical treatment under EPSDT. Well, continuing to slide three, when the screening is done, then the treatment, the T in EPSDT, is triggered. The importance of the child obtaining medical treatment is triggered, and again, there is a very important advocacy role for the GAL or the GAL attorney or the attorney ad litem in this setting, to ensure that, if necessary, when a parent is unable to give consent to treatment or the parent refuses to consent to necessary treatment for a child, advocacy before the judge to secure a court order for such treatment is something that DCF ordinarily would perform, but certainly as a fallback, the guardian ad litem, the attorney ad litem, should be there to ensure that the child can receive necessary treatment as recommended in the screening and to obtain a court order to require that such treatment be provided to the child at this stage of the proceedings. Now, in slide five, we turn to advocacy to ensure appropriate health care treatment for the child at the time the child is court ordered into DCF care, subsequent to the dispositional phase of the Chapter 39 process. And as all of you know, this is very basic to all of you who practice day-to-day in dependency court. Every child who is under the jurisdiction of the court, who is in licensed care, and children, obviously, who are not in care of DCF but are under some court supervision and under DCF supervision, must have a case plan describing the tasks that the parent must comply with and the services that need to be provided to the parent and to the child. And of course, this is supposed to delineate the types of services or treatment that will be provided to the child as well. And these, of course, include medical needs that have been identified during the screening process and during the comprehensive assessment process that are pertinent to the child's medical needs, identified medical needs. Well, that sort of leads to a rhetorical question, which I will pose to you all, which is asked on slide eight of my PowerPoint, and which is, why do we advocate for foster children's health care needs? I mean, it's sort of a no-brainer, but I think I need to sort of preach to you a little bit and to say that what we know about these children is that their healthcare needs are quite severe, quite chronic, and quite acute, as identified in a very seminal article published in the Journal of the American Academy of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry in 1997. Being in foster care is a defining experience in these children's lives. They are at risk in many different ways, just by virtue of being poor, having chronic health care needs, suffering trauma of abuse and neglect, suffering from a gamut of emotional challenges. The medical needs of these children are quite different, demonstrably different than their peers who are not in care. And so it's very important for those of us who advocate for these children every day in court to be attendant to their health care needs. I also, at slide 9, reference a couple of other key articles that, by the way, are attached to the emailing that was sent to you all Monday afternoon, so that you can look at scanned copies of different reports and surveys of the health care needs of these clients. While they're a little bit older, they're still very relevant, these pieces, to the day-to-day needs, unmet health care needs that you will be identifying and working to ameliorate and to remediate in your day-to-day advocacy for clients. So having identified that this is a key issue in a guardian ad litem's advocacy for a child or an attorney's advocacy for a child, what are the tools that Chapter 39 provides us to ensure that that our clients are receiving medically necessary health care treatment from doctors and health and other health care providers? Well, one of the best advocacy tools that that exists in Chapter 39 is pasted at slide 10, in 39.6012. Description of the case plan must incorporate detailed information about the child's health, mental health, and educational providers. Without the names of those doctors, mental health providers, and other professionals involved in the care and the treatment of the child, the case plan is incomplete. And so in scrutinizing case plans, which I think we all recognize are very boilerplate frequently and are put together in a sort of a slapdash, sloppy way, I think it's our job as advocates for these children to carefully scrutinize these case plans to ensure that we have accurate, up-to-date information about the type of treatment that the child is receiving from health and mental health providers in particular, and incidentally, also educational providers, that we have an accurate, up-to-date account of the child's health care status. And turning to slide 11, that there is an accurate medical history of the child, including any known problems that the child has experienced from birth to the day that the child enters DCF and the dependency system, that is recorded into the case plan. And this would include, obviously, whatever medications the child is on. There are frequently lapses in terms of ensuring that a child who's prescribed a medication for asthma or for a mental health condition, that medication is made available to the child and administered to the child, notwithstanding the removal of the child from the parents or the legal custodian's care and placement in shelter and ultimately in foster care. It is our responsibility to make the systems accountable to the child to ensure that the child's medical history is up to date and accurate, that the child's medications are current and that are able to be renewed and that the meds that the child requires are being administered to the child. I've provided to you an example as an attachment to this PowerPoint of a very, very detailed report by a child's attorney ad litem on DCF's administration of psychotropic meds that my office prepared a number of years ago as an illustration of what advocates for children should be doing in the juvenile dependency and foster care proceedings to make sure that the health care that is being provided to the children is meeting the actual needs of the child. And this lengthy attorney ad litem report was produced by our office after a methodical review of the healthcare history of a client of ours who was receiving treatment in a SIP program in South Florida, and there were concerns about whether or not the medications that she was on were causing some side effects that were potentially harmful to her. And so while this was a project undertaken by lawyers and law students, what we did was we dug through her health care charts at the facility. We contacted doctors. We went to great lengths to ensure that that our client, in the absence of a parent to look over her, and to ensure that the court's oversight of her treatment was meeting her needs, that this was done scrupulously to ensure that she was receiving proper healthcare treatment. So this report, I think, is worth looking at and considering as a model of the type of healthcare information gathering that is incumbent upon all of us to do for our child clients, and the attendant advocacy that sometimes is necessary to undertake in dependency court. I've also given you a citation at the bottom of slide 11 to a significant Florida Supreme Court decision, FG versus Agency for Persons with Disabilities. This particular case was litigated in the circuit court in the 11th Judicial Circuit before Judge Cindy Lederman, and it concerned the unwillingness of a provider agency, namely the Agency for Persons with Disabilities, to give information to the court concerning the child's status with the Medicaid waiver program and the child's receipt of services. What the Florida Supreme Court decided was that the court has broad authority, broad power to subpoena information from officials to ensure that the court itself has access to and can review med waiver information concerning the child. And I think by analogy, what this decision suggests, it's a very well-written opinion by Justice Raul Quintero. What it suggests is that we advocates for our child clients ought to be using the court's subpoena power to ensure that if an agency or a medical provider is not providing to the advocate for the child, and most importantly to the court itself, current and accurate healthcare information about the child's health needs, then this violates fundamental principles that are embedded in Chapter 39 in terms of the power of the court to review the healthcare status of the child. In slides 12, again, to emphasize that case plans must, when they are prepared at the beginning stage and when they are amended at other junctures in the juvenile foster care process, that health care information and mental health information must be incorporated into an amended case plan. And to repeat, I think it's incumbent upon us to review that information and ensure that it is up to date and accurate, and that it attests to the provision of health care services for our clients. Now, shifting a little bit to judicial review advocacy pursuant to 39.701 and at page or slide 13, here too, there is an important proactive role that we can all play in judicial review hearings to ensure that our clients' medical needs are being met by those responsible for providing care for and treatment for our clients. And so 39.701 subsection 6C speaks to the ability to pursue rules to show cause against the Department of Children and Families, for example, if it has failed to comply with its obligations as specified in the written case plan to provide services to our clients. This is a point that I think was well analyzed and emphasized by the 11th Circuit in the 31 Foster Children versus Bush case, which was on all accounts a rather disappointing decision concerning the federal court's authority to enforce the rights of children in state care. At slide 14, you'll see the citation and a parenthetical holding of that particular aspect of that decision. What the court nevertheless found was and emphasized was that the juvenile court itself has statutory authority to ensure DCF compliance with case plan obligations, including contempt authority and the authority to issue protective orders in support of or as conditions to any other orders that have been previously rendered by the court. How does this play into health rights advocacy? Well, for one, as I've indicated, if agencies that are treating children are not providing the court with current and accurate health care information about your child client, which you will need if you're going to pursue remedies for clients in fair hearings, then you certainly have the ability to utilize the contempt powers of the court and to seek protective orders if necessary within the framework of the judicial review process to make sure that accurate information is being provided to you, the guardian ad litem, or the attorney ad litem for the child. I'll skip over, and because of the shortness of time, to the next couple of slides and then turn us to slide 17, which refers to medical passports, which under Florida law are the written health history of a child in shelter status or in foster care. This is what every parent would keep for their own child, namely the medical history of the child so that they can take the child to doctors and get checkups and make sure that the child's immunizations are up to date, et cetera, et cetera. Well, similarly, for children in shelter status or in foster care, the caregiver, the foster parent, must be provided with a medical passport that must be updated at each health care visit. And ordinarily, the CBC case managers are required to maintain accurate medical passports for the children that they are case managing. And so part of our responsibility is to make sure that the medical passport obligations, as defined under Florida law, and by the way, federal law as well, because I've cited to the provision in ASFA, 42 U.S.C. section 675.1c, there is a requirement that the foster care parent or caregiver be given the child's full medical and educational records when they assume care for the child. We know from, and I'll just quickly summarize the findings of the Orange Item Report that is described in slide 18 and slide 19. We know that DCF has a sorry history of maintaining seriously deficient healthcare records, incomplete records, inaccurate records for children in care, as the Statewide Advocacy Council found in its 2002 Orange Item Report, and you have a link to it in the slide presentation if you're interested in reading it. The juvenile court itself has the authority, as happened in 2001 in Broward County. Judge John Frusciante issued an omnibus order relating to medical passports and healthcare history. It's one of the attachments to the email that was mailed to you all 2 days ago. It's worth looking at because it speaks to the authority that the juvenile court itself can exercise with respect to ensuring that medical passports and other healthcare histories are kept up to date for the clients that you serve. Slide 20 refers to just a policy pronouncement of the American Academy of Pediatrics that medical record keeping be scrupulously maintained for these children because of the serious chronic needs that they have, but also for the importance of ensuring that children are receiving appropriate health care. So to sort of sum up, I provided in the last two pages of my PowerPoint a few take-home advocacy tips to repeat. You want to be there to ensure that timely medical screenings for children and out-of-home care are done pursuant to 39.407. Where necessary, you need to advocate for medical treatment for children and out-of-home care and seek court orders for necessary treatment where parental consent cannot be obtained. It's important to advocate for the inclusion of appropriate medical treatment and services as they are identified within the case plan pursuant to 39.6012. At the judicial review hearings that many of you attend twice a year and more frequently for the 17 through 18-year-old clients that you are representing, to ensure that DCF complies with its obligations under the case plan and utilize contempt powers where necessary to compel DCF to comply with any ordered treatment or services, advocate for DCF to maintain accurate and up-to-date information concerning the healthcare needs of your child's healthcare status, use the courts where necessary, the broad subpoena power to obtain information and testimony from officials in APD and sister agencies of the department with respect to med waiver treatment and services and other healthcare services. And lastly, I think guardians ad litem in particular can, where there are serious concerns that a child isn't receiving appropriate EPSDT-insured services, ask the court to appoint counsel for a child to pursue the enforcement of the child's health care rights through a fair hearing. And I provided you with a sample order of appointment as one of the attachments that you can utilize when you are concerned that a child has been improperly denied a medically necessary service or the amount of the service has been reduced or the service has been terminated. That should be the trigger. That should be the red flag to pursue rights that the juvenile dependency court itself does not possess, but which the administrative structure allows, and that is the pursuit of medically necessary services for the child within the context of a fair hearing. And so that's really my quick presentation of what you can do as a juvenile court advocate to ensure that your child is receiving appropriate medical screenings and services and treatment. And I guess we'll open it up for questions.
Hello?
Yeah.
I have a question. When you're asking the court to appoint counsel for the child to get the services that the child needs, where is this? Is this private counsel, and who's paying for this?
Well, the idea occurred to me after a conversation that I had with Dennis Moore at a conference, the National Association of Counsel for Children conference in Savannah earlier this summer. Dennis was very clear in telling me and representing to me that there was, you know, while the resources of the Guardian Ad Litem program, the statewide Guardian Ad Litem program, are limited, and maybe the expertise in this area, this very specialized area of advocacy, is limited, that they recognize, the program recognizes the importance of cooperative partnerships with legal services programs. Miriam and I work in programs that receive funds from the Florida Bar Foundation.
Okay.
Well, the Children's Legal Services Grant Program, and we are trying to develop a body of expertise and skill sets that we can utilize in this context. We have a task force or a work group consisting primarily of legal services programs that focuses on advocacy, both service advocacy and systemic advocacy in the EPSDT area. And so I think the natural idea here, or the linkage here, is between the GAL program and the legal services community. I don't know if Miriam wanted to add anything to that.
Right. No, I think that makes a lot of sense. We don't intend for guardian ad litems to have to take on a whole new litigation portfolio, but that, you know, sometimes there's a breakdown in, there's been a problem identified with a child who's gotten a notice terminated and reducing services, and it's unclear who can actually even request that the child file a fair hearing request on behalf of the child.
Right.
And let me ask Bernie if this might work also, also circulated sample orders that might allow the court to authorize the GAL to retain counsel for the child to pursue fair hearing or whatever other legal remedies might be appropriate regarding medically necessary services.
Right, and that would be another just procedural vehicle to ensure that there's a specialized counsel for the limited purpose of enforcing the child's health care rights that the GAL program itself can retain. And I don't see anything inappropriate about that. I think it would be, a win-win. The guardian ad litem program would have a little more strength and a little more extra advocacy tools at its disposal if it were done in that fashion.
Okay. Now, if the legal services, local legal services, cannot accept a case of this nature, then what you're saying is our next course of action should be for the program, the GAL program itself, to try to retain an attorney. I know our funds are very slim now, so
I don't want to speak for all legal services programs, but not only do they get a number of them get the funding from the Barr Foundation to do work on behalf of children in care, but they're also the federally funded legal services programs. And the issue really is if there's documented evidence that the child needs a medically necessary service that's covered under the federal Medicaid statute and it's being denied, delayed, terminated, or reduced, then that child has a what we would call a good case.
Okay.
And we would, legal services, Florida legal services, and working with the field programs, the other legal services programs would do, and possible pro bono counsel, we would, I think if there is a doctor, and the key, you really need to have a doctor who is willing to go to bat for the child and provide the supportive evidence that the service at issue is necessary. Given that you've got, if you have that, those facts and the law, I don't think the GALs need to worry about taking on the financial burden of representing the child or finding or hiring counsel to do so.
Okay.
What you have to do, what we rely on you for is the link in getting the coordination between the physician and getting all of the medical evidence that Bernie has talked about, and the making the connection with legal services and getting them that information and being able to sign the retainers and releases and HIPAA releases that would enable us to do investigation and go forward with advocacy.
Okay. Thank you.
Does anybody else have any questions that you'd like to ask?
I have one. Can you hear me? Bernie?
Yeah.
You discussed here quickly the medical passports by the foster parents. Are you aware of or do you know of a standard format of any sort of a booklet or a binder that's been prepared by DCF or the American Academy of Pediatrics that might suggest a format and a methodology to use for this information collecting and keeping?
Yeah, I think, well, both the administrative code and I think I gave you guys a link to the American Academy of Pediatrics, but particularly the Florida Administrative Code is very explicit in spelling out exactly what is supposed to be contained in that. Individual CBCs and lead agencies have developed their own adaptation of that code requirement, and you know, they used to refer to these, they sometimes refer to these as the Blue Book. So there are protocols that have been officially mandated by the administrative code, and then have been you know, at the local level, at the CBC level, have been adopted. But I think this is an area that you know, sort of a systemic area of advocacy to ensure that local agencies are following the best practices. And I think the best practices are contained in the recommendations of the American Academy of Pediatrics as to what are the contents of a proper medical passport for a child in care.
Thank you.
Okay, if nobody has any other questions, we might want to just wrap it up. It's about 1 o'clock. Thank you so much, Bernie and Miriam. It was a great presentation and a lot of great information.